Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with George Packer. We previously talked about his National Book Award winning The Unwinding, last year about his Atlantic article, We Are Living in a Failed State. And today, we'll talk about his latest book, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal, in which he offers his take on four dominant narratives of America that motivate and divide us. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. Now to today's conversation. We're going to dig into those four narratives, the real America, the free America, the smart America, and the just America. I talked with George Packer in 2013 about the people and the ideas in his book, The Unwinding. That was 3 years before the Electoral College victory of Donald Trump. Through stories of individual Americans, the book reported and reflected on a country. Packer argued that economic shifts created a country of winners and losers, and that left the social contract in pieces, and it set citizens adrift to find new paths forward. You will see, I think, as we talk about the four narratives, how that ongoing process of the unwinding fed into these narratives and how they bump up against each other. Plato's challenge. Plato believed that democracy would inevitably lead to tyranny because the rich will always want to get richer. This leads to extremes of wealth and poverty, and the poor will ultimately follow any demagogue who promises to overthrow the rich, and that will lead to tyranny. And to me, the last few years have really brought Plato's paradox front and center. Given the four Americas that Packer sees and the multiple of crises we face, we're going to talk about also the cost of minority rule. Even if the majority of Americans are ready to deal with inequality, healthcare, climate, racial justice, jobs, workers, pandemics, can our democracy work well enough to allow even that majority to move the country forward in time to deal successfully with such crises? George Packer is a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of The Unwinding and Inner History of the New America, The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq, Our Man, Richard Holbrooke, and The End of the American Century, both the last two books finalists for the Pulitzer Prize. George is also the author of a couple of novels and a play and editor of a two-volume edition of The Essays of George Orwell. Welcome, George Packer, again to Free Forum, a world that just might work.
Thanks for having me back, Terrence.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Monday, August 16th. This is a very different book for you. Now, I said you've written plays, you've written novels, so you've written different books before. But this one, most of your recent books, at least, have involved a good deal of reporting. You go out on the road, you do it, you know, whether it's to Iraq or whether it's to Tampa, Florida, and you meet people and you develop a book from your research. This one, partially because of the pandemic and the isolation, is completely different. How did that happen? When did you decide you had to write this book?
Well, that's a good thumbnail of my career. I mean, I am a failed novelist. I love reading fiction. The novel is sort of the Uber form in my head. So in the past, whenever I've sat down to write a work of nonfiction, because it took me a good 10 or 15 years to figure out that I am a better nonfiction writer than fiction writer, I have one or another novel in mind as a model, whether it's by Joseph Conrad or John Dos Passos or I don't know who. And that means I need a story. I need characters. I need a rich descriptive texture. I need to be there for a long time and get the feel of a place and of a person under my skin. And in the pandemic, I was one of the lucky non-essentials. Yeah. Who could sit at home in front of a laptop and still get a paycheck. So that was both a blessing and a kind of a curse because it meant I was stuck with myself for a very long time and my family was stuck with me. And about midsummer of last year, as one convulsive event after another shook the country. I mean, what a year it was. Have we had a year like that since 1968 or even earlier? I don't think so. I just thought I have to try to make sense of this and use my enforced sedentary idleness to read, to go back into some American history. I read a lot of Tocqueville. I read Whitman and Lincoln. I read Walter Lippmann. I read Bayard Rustin. I read Francis Perkins, all these great figures from American history, in order to try to understand the year 2020 in terms of both deep old patterns in this country and the more recent, let's say the last 4 or 5 decades worth of social and economic and political trends. And to do all that in the interest of finding a way out of this. I'm tired of writing books that people describe as books about American decline. Mm-hmm. I've got small children. I can't keep being a poet or a prophet of decline. And so essentially I sat down to write, you could say, an essay or maybe even a pamphlet, to refer to a kind of old venerable literary form. A short, sharp book that intervenes in a particular moment at a time of crisis, but also tries to look at it in terms of history and to write it in a way that would last. So that was my ambition. There's some great pamphlets that I love by writers like James Baldwin, I would say The Fire Next Time, George Orwell, his book about socialism and England in the middle of the Blitz in 1940. And so this was my modest effort to write that kind of book, because I couldn't write a narrative. I was unable to do the work you have to do to, mm-hmm. to write narrative nonfiction.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. I'm guessing that at first you're not sure that there's a book or what the book will be. You're just trying to figure out what's going on and how we're going to get out of this.
Exactly. I didn't have an answer when I sat down to write. This was not an op-ed in the form of a book. It was an exploration of my own thinking, of history, of the country, of everything I've learned as a writer and reporter in the last 20 years. It's sort of a crystallization of the books that preceded it, right, especially the unwinding.
The other ones, you did your research, you wrote the stories, you drew the conclusions, and now where do those conclusions take you?
In a sense, time to put your cards on the table.
Yeah.
And not sink my own thoughts into the history of other people's lives and mm-hmm. the story of other people's struggles.
How did it emerge that the kind of the center of it would be these four Americas, these four narratives?
Well, so I had already come up with something like a typology of four ideas of American identity that have kind of dominated my adult life. I've been working on that out through a talk I gave in a couple of places. I didn't really have it down, but I knew I was onto something. But I didn't have the right names. It was a bit fuzzy. But I thought that could be an anchor for the book. It was something I already had. It was not, I didn't have to, improvise the entire thing, which is scary when you sit down. And mm-hmm, I also didn't have much time. I felt like I had to get this done really quickly. Whereas usually a book takes me 4 years. This one took me about 4 months. So I had the rough outline of four Americas, but the first thing I did was to sit down and write from the moment I was in, and that was October of last year, and it was an ominous, dreadful time. I mean, you're in California, wildfires, smoke covering the cities of the Bay Area and elsewhere, storms on the Gulf Coast, but beyond that, the pandemic coming back, mm-hmm. Trump essentially vowing to contest the election if it didn't go his way, and that contesting really meaning violence. And there was a profound sense among people I was talking to that we could be headed for some kind of low-grade civil war. There's a lot of people buying guns and ammunition. people just simply wondering, is this all going to come apart after the election? So that urgency is what propelled me finally to sit down and start writing. And so the first pages are essentially from that moment of profound anxiety about the future of the country. And then how did we get to this point, and can we get ourselves out of it?
Okay, let's dig in now to the four Americas. I've done plenty of thinking about them. I have a bunch of questions, but let me open it up for you to sort of lay out, and let me just set up for you that you sort of place them in a chronological order of their emergence, and you suggest that some of them perhaps emerge as responses to earlier ones. But with that setup, can you sort of lay out these four narratives?
Sure. Just as a kind of framework for them, I think they all four are reactions to the two big tidal events of the last half century in this country. The first is the rise of what I call a multi-everything democracy, a country in which for the first time, it was not a given that white men were the inheritors of all power and the people who would set the terms of the culture and politics and economy. This had to do with immigration from around the world after the 1965 immigration law. This had to do with the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, and other movements of disfranchised groups. So basically, the emergence of a multi-everything country. And at the same time, the eclipse of the industrial economy and the rise of the information economy, which created whole new groups of profoundly unequal winners and losers, so that you had both a cultural and social shift and an economic dislocation. And I think those two big trends have created so much resentment, competition, a sense of a zero-sum game, of a scramble for status, that it's not as though we were a profoundly united country before, but we had, I think, a more coherent identity.
Yeah, and, yeah, let me jokingly say, there was a Venn in that Venn diagram.
Exactly. You could say the Venn was Walter Cronkite, right?
Yeah.
Beginning in the early 70s, these four narratives, I think, succeeded each other in dominating our culture. And I want to say right away, this is not a demographic portrait of the country. This inevitably leaves out less dominant narratives and the people who subscribe to them. These are the ones that have essentially controlled the terms of our culture and our politics. And the first and really strongest is what I call free America, which is Reagan's America.
Yeah.
It's the America of the market, of get government out of my life, cut my taxes, don't regulate my business, and there will be freedom and prosperity for all who want it, for all who are willing to work. And that was the promise of the shining city on a hill, and it was a very persuasive narrative for quite a while, and in fact set the terms, the parameters of what was thinkable and sayable in politics for a really long time, starting in the early 1980s. So,
yep. And let me just say a couple of quick things. You say sort of that earlier, prior to the emergence of this free America, that the two sort of tracks of the Republicans or the conservatives and the Democrats or the, you know, liberals was, one was get ahead, it's America, make your life. There was a middle class. You could get ahead. And the other was give everybody a fair shake. And you can see where there's plenty of overlap between those. And so I just wanted to set up, that's kind of where we were. That was the politics pre-Reagan. And then Reagan comes through and takes it. The reason that I bring that up is because you say it, but partially because of his delivery, his demeanor, his optimism, the darker side of his narrative, of that free narrative, wasn't obvious. It looked like everyone could get a fair shake in the Reagan narrative, sort of.
That's exactly right. And those terms that I use, fair shake, get ahead, they're sort of old-fashioned terms, and they refer to slightly less ideologically sharp-edged narratives. There was more overlap. Mm-hmm. If you were a small businessman in the middle of the country in the 1950s, if you owned a pharmacy or if you worked for a small corporation, you were a Republican. You were perhaps a conservative, but you were not a believer in gutting all public investment. You wanted there to be good public schools. You wanted there to be a government that could, take care of infrastructure and
you may have benefited from the GI Bill and the FHA loan and the interstate highway system.
Exactly. There was more of a sense that government had to play a role. There was a sort of contract between business, labor, and government that they all needed each other. They all had to be at the table. And even though there would be a lot of competition and elections would be bitterly fought, and there would be figures like Joe McCarthy, speaking of demagogues, who would upset the entire game, nonetheless, politics was played more between the 40-yard lines, and people could talk to each other without feeling that they were existential threats. The one exception, and the obvious one, was for Black Americans, who were written out of this entire deal until the 60s. And I would say the key moment for the Democratic Party was when the Fair Shake, which was its narrative up until the 70s, extended in the 60s to Black people. And that was part of what set in motion the fracturing that we're now talking about into the four narratives. The Fair Shake was more encompassing, and so was getting ahead. And they did not require a death struggle with the other narrative in order to feel as if they had a place in the game. So Free America had its incredible heyday, and even as it waned a bit, continued to influence the successive narratives. And the one that comes after in my chronology, as well as typologically, is what I call Smart America. I think of that as the America of the Clintons, the America of the 90s going on to the Obama years, which is really the meritocracy, the belief that education is the key to success and that talent and effort are going to be rewarded and the most intelligent will be those who receive the rewards. And it's in some ways it sounds like a fair system because those who do best on tests should be the ones who get the best jobs and get the most money, except that meritocracy has actually not worked out as such. It's become, I think, a kind of aristocracy in which families guarantee that their children will remain in the meritocracy by birth and by family connections and by family efforts. And in a sense, merit has become a bit of a sham. And instead, we have a new class system in which the top 10%, who are really the winners of the information economy, live a sort of separate and superior life, have their own language, their own cultural style. They recognize each other, they marry each other, they live around each other, they go to school with each other. And so meritocracy, rather than creating a more fluid and equal opportunity society, I think has hardened the stratification. And
let me just say that when I first came across that thought of yours, I thought it didn't sound quite right to me. I know that the elite colleges took advantage of one of the booms to actually make it that the middle class could get into them. At the time that I went to college, basically the rich could afford elite colleges, the poor could get scholarships, and the middle class was left out. And most of the elite colleges changed their financial need to make it opener to the middle class. I certainly have seen, the immigrants from, I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but like from East Asia and so on become...
And South Asia. Sure.
Yeah, become the, that certainly that 10% and probably that 5% and, maybe that 2 or 3%. But what you're saying is not just your intuition. It's not just your gut feeling. You went back and looked at the numbers and it has sort of frozen itself and is no longer, I mean, I know we've lost social mobility, but I didn't think that was this problem. I thought this was another one.
I think they're related problems. Our social mobility has declined dramatically, you're right, in the last few decades. We are now less socially mobile than most European countries, which is a reversal because social mobility was always our claim to being.
Absolutely.
We always had a harsh brand of capitalism, but we said it's harsh because anyone can make it and anyone does make it. Well, once that's no longer true and people are stuck for their lives in the place where they're born, then the harshness has no justification. But you know, one statistic that bears out what we're talking about is something I saw in a study by a Berkeley professor. Getting into one of the top Ivy League universities for someone born into the bottom 20% of the economy is no easier now than it was 60 years ago. After the GI Bill, after the civil rights movement, the women's rights movement, the opening, as you said, of the top universities to the middle class and the working class, after all of that, it's the same. And that's because it has become so competitive and the advantages are so built in, whether it's test prep tutoring or going to the right high schools because you're born in the right zip code, or the parents are relentless in training their children for the meritocracy by reading the right books and taking them to the right museums. It's become a kind of family business success.
Yeah.
And families will do anything in this class to avoid having their children fall out of it.
So, right. And I think one thing you're saying is many of those parents, they emerged in a previous era, a previous generation, when in fact there was more advancement, it seems.
Yes.
And then they learned because they learned how to keep it going.
They did. They became experts at success.
Yeah.
And success became the motive, the holy grail. Getting, the US News and World Report ranking of top universities became like the Bible of smart America families.
Yeah.
And the difference between the top universities and the rest, and between any university and no college education, became so profound that the anxiety, the stakes, the status competition blew up.
Thing you're saying there, George, is that what we were just talking about is one trend. The other trend that's happening simultaneously, which is why you end up with the outcome you point out, is the loss of manufacturing jobs and the weakening of unions, right? In other words,
the cost
of not going to college increased enormously at the same time as these people were getting better at getting their kids in.
That's right. I mean, the great shift away from the industrial economy meant that a college degree became the only way to a comfortable life, a secure life.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, blue collar work and service work became increasingly perilous and fragile. And it was really the decline of unions that took away whatever power workers had had. And so I would say one of the fundamental facts of my four narratives is the decline of workers and the rise of business and professional elites. That has informed all four narratives, but has sent them in different directions.
Exactly. And it is to their, not to their credit, that those people you spoke of as the leading lights of Smart America were the ones who went gung-ho for globalization. On the one hand, they favor this meritocracy. On the other hand, it was on their watch that an awful lot of that loss of the middle class happened and was set in motion for the future.
I mean, that key moment of the debate between Al Gore and Ross Perot, I think in 1993 or 4 over NAFTA, showed these fault lines. Gore was a prince of smart America, Harvard and you know,
son of
every
a senator.
Right institution, son of a senator. And Gore argued a side that most educated people took for granted, which was, of course, free trade is good. It will reduce global tensions. It will create connections between countries. It will increase prosperity across the board. It's inevitable. It's the way the world is moving, blah, blah, blah. Ross Perot was a hick. He sounded like, you know, some kind of gas station owner in Nowheresville, Texas. People could easily dismiss this guy because he was talking about the past and people who really needed to get with the program or else they were going to get run over by the globalization train. Well, who looks smarter now? Who looks more prescient now? It'd be interesting to go back and watch that debate because I think Ross Perot would not look like such a hick.
That's right.
Today.
Those charts he held up would be more persuasive right now. But the other thing that goes back to one thing you said earlier is you said that free America set the terms. So smart America is clearly it's democratic. Clearly it's, you know, it's not Republican. It's not Reaganism, but the era of big government is over is not Reagan, it's Clinton.
Right. It's free trade. It's deregulation that continued dramatically under Bill Clinton, telecommunications, finance, et cetera. He did raise taxes on the rich a little bit, but it was pretty marginal. Essentially, a different class, I would say, came into power. Under Reagan, it was the business class. Under Clinton, it was the professional class. Mm. But their interests were aligned, and they didn't disagree all that much about economic policy. They had different ideas, perhaps, about things like environmental regulations, about affirmative action, about what you might call the softening of capitalism.
Yeah.
And the softening of inequality. But fundamentally, there was not a big difference. And that was politically accounted, I think, in part for the abandonment of the Democratic Party by the white working class, which had been part of its core, its backbone, and which both because of the civil rights movement and black empowerment, and also because the Democratic Party became the party of globalization and of liberalization of the economy. I think those two things meant that the white working class said, well, we're at least going to go for the party that takes us seriously, that doesn't condescend to us.
Right.
And that was the Republican Party.
You know, it's funny. I found myself thinking as you were speaking there, George, about how there's this tradition of who lost Korea, who lost China. And in this case, it's who lost the middle class, you know? and
exactly.
You know, we don't usually ask that kind of question, but by God, it's true.
You know, Bill Clinton had this summit meeting at the White House in the year 2000. This was perhaps the high point of optimism in our recent history. It was on the new economy. He had everyone from Alan Greenspan to Bill Gates to Amartya Sen, and they were in a mood of immense self-congratulation. And Bill Clinton got up and said, the internet will free more people from poverty than any invention in human history. And he also announced, we're about to sign our first trade agreement with China. Congress is about to push that through. And these two things were supposed to give everyone the sense that the sky was the limit. And you could say, in a way, that was the moment when the election of Donald Trump became thinkable.
Yeah. And the only thing is, I would say, I'd link that, George, to another event, which would be when the Supreme Court stopped the vote counting in Florida. I often think that's what inevitably led to the election of Trump, because it brought in minority rule. But the two of them together, the overconfidence on the one hand and the ruthlessness on the other. You know, we don't know what Gore certainly was about as close to Clinton as you could be, but perhaps we wouldn't have had the attack on 9/11. Perhaps we wouldn't have invaded Iraq. Perhaps a few other things might have happened without that election. We're at about the midway point. I want to tell people this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with journalist and best-selling author George Packer. And on the show, we've previously talked about his book, The Unwinding, his articles, including We Are Living in a Failed State. And we're talking today about his latest book, Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal, in which he offers his take, and this is what we're talking about right now, four dominant narratives that sort of define our, at least our political dialogue. And nowadays, that's a lot of what goes on. You can learn more about the book at Macmillan.com, M-A-C-M-I-L-L-A-N, Macmillan.com, the publisher. And you can find his all of his Atlantic articles, and he's got a couple of new ones hot off the keyboard, one on Afghanistan and one on these narratives. You can do that at TheAtlantic.com. I assume we're about to shift to real America. And the one thing I wanted to do was just point out a couple of things that I want to make sure people got about the first one, Free America, the Reagan one, which was that, as a great line you say, legal segregation was barely dead when Free America, using the libertarian language of individualism and property rights, pushed the country into its long decline in public investment. So while I pointed out that Clinton said the era of big government is over, it's Reagan who said, government is not the solution, government is the problem. And one other thing you say, and I think I just want to lay these in there because I think they're the dark side. Free America, another quote from you, saw Americans as entrepreneurs, employees, investors, taxpayers, consumers, everything but citizens. So what you have kind of as the foundation that Free America sets is that we're not going to invest that much in government, whether it's financially or culturally. It's going to become less about self-governance and less about government doing anything for you. So I just wanted to, that was the foundation. Then Smart America was a reaction, and now Real America.
And Real America is a rebellion. It's a populist narrative. It's an anti-elite narrative. It's a phrase Sarah Palin used in the 2008 campaign when she said at a fundraiser in North Carolina, I love coming to these places in the real America where people are patriotic and grow our food and fight our wars and teach our children and work in our factories. So she's talking about basically the heartland, the white Christian heartland. She didn't use those words, but that's what everyone knew she meant. And that's who flocked to her rallies. And that was a class of Americans who were doing pretty badly by that time. They were not benefiting from all the promises of trickle-down prosperity that had come with free America. They still used the word freedom. It was an important word for Palin and for her followers. But it meant something new. It really didn't mean you're going to get rich by investing in your own corporation or going to Wall Street. It meant essentially, leave me alone. Don't tell me what to do. Don't tell me I can't drink a Coke, as one woman told me on Election Day 2010 in Virginia. And she thought Al Gore was telling her how to, what she could eat and drink and what kind of light bulb she had to use. Get off my property. Don't tread on me. That's what freedom means in what Palin called real America. It's a pessimistic narrative. It sees America in decline. It sees the backbone of America, as this group sees itself, the white working class, in decline, being pushed out of line by newcomers and being condescended to by coastal elites. And the level of venom that became, gathered in this narrative was, I think it took a long time for us in the media and political elites to understand it, because we didn't, most journalists and politicians don't talk to these people.
That's
and
right.
Don't hear from them. So 2012 convention, I was there in Tampa. It was the Republican convention was still all about entrepreneurship, makers and takers. That was Romney. That was Paul Ryan. But meanwhile, the mass, the base of the party was going in a different direction. They were going in the direction of hostility to foreigners, to immigrants, hostility to trade agreements, suspicion of institutions,
suspicion of people with degrees and who talked fancy and who told them what they couldn't say because it was incorrect. All of this obviously leads us straight to Donald Trump. He is the inheritor of the beginnings of Real America, and he turned it into a kind of tidal wave that swept up all kinds of people who might not have even quite thought this way yet, but he allowed it. He told people, you can say these things, you can think these things. In fact, they make you the real Americans. And so it was a release, a kind of a liberation for at his rallies for people to be able to hear him say what he would said.
Yeah.
And that became the narrative of the base of the Republican Party, not the elites. They continued with the mantras of free America, tax cuts and deregulation. And in a way, that I think was more the governing agenda of Trump than anything he had campaigned on in real America. But real America was where the energy was and still is.
Obviously.
And so that shift is a profound, you know, fracture on one side of our red-blue divide. My four Americas show that we are not only divided into red and blue, but each of those is further divided.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And free and real are in some ways the battleground in the Republican Party.
Right. And let me say a couple of things about the real America. One is I recommend the book Strangers in Their Own Land by Arlie Hochschild. In which, I mean, you use the image that becomes sort of the defining image in the story that she believes many in southern Louisiana who have been ruined by oil industries and chemical companies and so on, who hate the government more than they do the corporations that have, you know, that have done them so poorly, which is this idea of jumping in line, of we're in line for the American dream, we don't seem to be moving. And now we see that, you know, Obama's inviting immigrants to jump ahead of us and gay people to jump ahead of us and on and on. And so I just say that whole book sort of is to develop that story. But that story is very much the story of these people. The other thing that you point out is that one thing that made the that empowered the anti-elite feeling was the failure on 9/11, the failure of the war in Iraq, the failure of the war in Afghanistan, and the financial crash of 2008 with no accountability for Wall Street. And if you're someone who's looking at what do those elites deliver, they got a losing streak and you're the one that's on the end of it.
Exactly. I mean, I saw a lot of this. Real America became real to me when I was reporting the unwinding during the Great Recession. I was in Western North Carolina a lot, a rural area, former tobacco and textile region. I was in Greater Youngstown, Ohio a lot. I was in Tampa Bay in the exurbs. And I saw the Tea Party at the beginning of its rise. You could say the Tea Party articulated real America, but still using the terms of free America, still talking about taxes and small government. It had not quite broken into something even darker, which was bigotry and nativism, xenophobia, cruelty, the language that Trump uses, the language I think of as like bringing Jersey Shore to national politics, where everyone gets to be their most debased self and feel that they're finally getting to tell the truth, which is another mark of a demagogue. He sort of brings us together as a kind of a mob that all recognize each other as fellow members of the mob, but it means it has to be against something else or someone else. And that's what Trump did in his rallies. So
yeah, it's interesting when you say Trump that, by should, the way, yeah. When you say that, January 6th just seems like the natural, you know, outcome of that. You speak to a mob, you say you're free to say what you've been thinking and you didn't feel like you could say, you're free to do it. Well, now go, you know, act on it. It's pretty wild that a demagogue excites a mob and then we end up with a mob inside the Capitol.
I think people of my generation, late baby boomers, Gen X, people in that, and earlier baby boomers, we don't have a lot of experience of this. Other than the upheavals of the 60s, which I only lived through as a very small kid, there's been essentially social peace for a long time. Obviously, every now and then there's a riot. Every now and then there's a big political clash. There's, you know, Oklahoma City bombing. But the idea that we're on the precipice of continuous political violence is not something most Americans alive today have ever reckoned with. And so it takes a very long time for people like us to accept that it might be real. I remember during the election last year, a doctor I know who's an Iranian American said to me, "You Americans don't understand how quickly this can happen and how far you will go down and how long it will take you to come back. I'm an Iranian. I saw it happen in my country. You need to take it seriously and understand it can happen here. It is happening here." I think our complacency is a big part of the problem of our inability to imagine a country that's continually, you know, convulsed with violence. Things have settled down again since January 6th, but the potential for more, this is jumping ahead a bit, but the potential for more is all still there with voting laws that turn state elections into partisan contests that will be judged by partisan referees, with conspiracy theories, with the big lie of the 2020 election just still inflaming Trump supporters, all of that, and with, as you have been pointing out, a system that gives a great advantage to a party in the minority so that 52% of the country feels disenfranchised. All of those are ingredients to me for more January 6th.
Yeah, in years to come. Just because I'm looking at the clock, with Just America, we may not get to what I mentioned at the top, which is minority rule. So I'm just going to pick up on what you just said and put it out there as kind of something that, you know, in another 15 minutes we'd have gotten to. But that is, I do think that in addition to all of what these narratives tell us about culture and politics and so on, that minority rule, in the recent Atlantic article, The Fifth America, in which you talk about sort of Biden's narrative and that sort of thing, you say that what can make a difference, and I think you've said it in other commentaries and a little bit in the book, is that if a Biden administration can deliver. In other words, how do you turn people from their cynicism and their hatred of government? Well, you deliver. You save them from a pandemic, you give them child tax credits, you pay for their community college, you know, you do things that actually make their life better, and they go, oh, well, that's different. And you peel off a few percent, and suddenly that base isn't so big. The problem that I worry about, and as I say, which I don't think we'll have time to talk about, unless we can turn to right at the end, is, does minority rule in the Senate, in the filibuster, in the state legislatures that are going to gerrymander districts and so on, does it frustrate...
In the Electoral College.
In the Electoral College. Does it frustrate the possibility of really government doing what government can and ought to be doing for the middle class and the working class and the people of America so far that the cynicism continues to win and it perpetuates itself? And that is a real fear of mine.
I think that is the question. I mean, the fifth narrative that I wrote about to some extent in Last Best Hope and then more explicitly in a recent Atlantic essay you mentioned called The Fifth Narrative, I call it Equal America.
Yeah.
It's, to me, it's the narrative that we begin with the fact that we are all of equal worth. That's the first line of first important line in the Declaration of Independence, that we are morally and politically equal, and that in a sense, we can all look each other in the eye as equal citizens. No group, no individual is locked out. No, the conditions of our life don't create permanent classes, permanent groups of the advantage and disadvantage. Obviously, we've never achieved that. We have failed spectacularly in some ways and eras, but it is a passion of Americans. Mm-hmm. Tocqueville called it the eternal passion to be equal, to be as good as everyone else. And it's an ideal in American society. And I think Biden intuitively knows that. He doesn't talk about it. He doesn't have that rhetorical gift that Reagan had or Roosevelt had. But his policies, his domestic policies, have really been geared toward giving the working class that has been so battered these past decades more status, more money, more opportunity. To take away some of the advantages of that meritocratic elite, yeah, and that business elite that we were talking about, to use infrastructure spending and COVID relief and other big spending bills to start to reverse inequality and monopoly and plutocracy, and to give ordinary people, working people, people maybe without a college education, greater respect as well as a better life. So to me, all of that is the only narrative that makes sense.
Yeah, and as we and as we both
it's
agree,
unifying.
If minority rule frustrates that at every turn, then the avenue toward a realignment where we become more of a together, you know, collaborative country, if that's taken away by minority rule, then, you know, things can get only darker. I want to point out one last
thing. Yes.
Oh,
go
one
ahead.
One thing about Trump, just so people who were, you know, this whole thing we were talking about elites, you point out that among white people, only 38% of college graduates voted for Trump. So he lost big among white college graduates, but 64% of whites without college degrees voted for Trump. And that really indicates the role of education in this separation. But I just wanted to throw that in there. What were you going to say? And then we've got to talk about Just America.
Well, this will take us to Just America.
Great.
Because I think if we see those statistics as they are, we realize that education is the fundamental polarizing line in America today. It's how you can best predict how people are going to vote, and even what kind of culture they're going to have, and how they're going to see the world and their own prospects in the world. And we are now in an era of what I think of as the metaphysics of group identity, in which for the left, it's not class, but the other identities, whether it's race, gender, disability, sexuality, are what define you from birth and what are your essence, in a sense. They're not accidents. They become your essence. I've always wanted to believe that those are accidents and that we are individuals who are not going to become the sum of the accidents of our birth. But I feel that progressive ideology at its most extreme has turned those into essences. And in doing so, it has lost sight of this other dividing line, which I think is fundamental, which is class and which is based on education. And in a sense, what I call Just America, which is the narrative of progressives today, in a sense, group identity has become a way of preserving class lines rather than breaking them down. And it divides the working class along group lines rather than uniting it. And so I think in a sense, it's become just as much of a force against equal America as the other three narratives. So I'm critical of it, even though in terms of politics and policy, it's probably where I come closest to having my own, you know, narrative. I still see it as moving in the wrong direction because it's becoming so rigidified and in a way illiberal.
Yeah.
With an ideology of identity that can't allow for individual variety and freedom and does not understand the material conditions and concerns of most Americans. So that's why it's forever misunderstanding the electorate and getting elections wrong and not understanding why the American people won't vote its way.
Here's a line from you. Just America has dramatically changed the way Americans think, talk, and act, but not the conditions in which they live. And we don't have time to give this justice, but for those of you who feel either that Just America is your narrative and is the best American narrative, or those who are, you know, disenchanted with woke culture and feel like it divides us in ways it needn't, whichever one, there's a quite, George goes into this in quite some depth in the book and in the article, The Four Americas in the Atlantic last year, or earlier this year. But the point that it deals, that it is very, very popular and persuasive on college campuses and with young people, and has become, as you point out, the Biden administration often uses the word equity instead of the word equality, and that's a shift. The defund the police, when in fact some in the black middle and working class community say no, our homicides are up. We need police. There's just a lot going on here that leaves me out ultimately. And one thing that I have realized, I was in college in the 60s, 65 to 69, and I think I would have a very tough time in a college campus today. I'm very glad that I came through at the time that I came through, a time of open expression and experimentation versus, as you point out, the illiberal rigidification of what one can say. But because it doesn't change material conditions, but just changes the way people think and talk and so on, it becomes, I think, easier for the right to attack than for the progressives to use it to make a difference.
And it leads to a lot of really futile battles over things like the teaching of critical race theory in schools, which the right has certainly exploited to its advantage.
Yes. But
which is not purely, it's not purely a right-wing invention. It's been exaggerated by the right and denied by the left. But I do want to say that just as real America comes out of frustrations and broken promises, so does Just America.
Yes.
It's a rebellion against, in a sense, against the meritocracy of the parents and the success pressure and the idea of a gradual but inevitably more perfect union that the Clintons and Barack Obama were always promising. And by the financial crisis and the recession, this new generation looked around and said, we don't see it. We don't see progress. In fact, we see debt. We see global warming. We see videos of police shooting unarmed black men. What progress are you talking about? And suddenly the gradual ameliorist view of smart America began to seem kind of like a complacent lie.
Yeah.
And so I want to give the grounds for how Just America emerged as such a potent narrative among younger people who came up in a world that did not look nearly as hopeful to them as perhaps the America of the 80s and 90s looked to a different generation.
Right. And it's interesting what, I mean, you know, what Just America seems to be a reaction to. One, as you point out, a reaction to the blind spots of smart America, but yeah, also a reaction to the vigorous assertions of real America under Trump. You know, it's like there's two of the other four Just America is a righteous reaction to.
Yeah, I think real America has inflamed Just America.
Exactly.
I mean, Trump gave it all the,
yeah,
the justification it needed to push things like whether it's you want to call cancel culture or woke culture into a very extreme direction, because Trump was displaying all the evils of the dark side of America on Twitter every day. So Real and Just America are locked in a mutually, you know, polarizing struggle. They're each driving the other into more and more extreme versions of itself, almost caricatures of itself. And meanwhile, Free and Smart America are both discredited in a sense.
Yep.
They don't have the energy and the conviction, which is why so many people, individuals from Smart America are abdicating to Just America,
yep,
are allowing journalists to be fired for writing or saying something considered wrong. That kind of surrender shows that Smart America kind of lost its guts, lost conviction in its own values. So that's why I see this landscape of four narratives, which cannot get us, none of them can get us out of either economic division or cultural division or a general sense that the country is in decline and might even be facing some kind of ultimate destruction. At the end of the book, I have my own proposals, none of them original with me, but which add up to what I call Equal America, which essentially starts out from the point of view that we have to see each other as equal citizens and as individuals, but as individuals all with a right to participate fully in our political and economic life. It's a kind of a democratic version, small d, of equality, which I think goes back to Whitman and forward to King and Bayard Rustin, and which is maybe a neglected tradition in this country, but which we need to either recover or invent in order to stop pursuing a kind of politics that requires mutual destruction, or that one side absolutely lose. And yet, as you say, our elections are designed now for an existential death struggle. And so two things are in conflict, colliding with each other. One is the need to create conditions of equality, which I think some of the Biden agenda is doing. But the other is a struggle over democracy and one party that actually is trying to undermine democracy. And those two things are, you know, at odds with each other. How do you both create conditions of equality and at the same time beat back an attempt to really undermine our democracy? Right. It's not easy to do, and I'm not sure it's going to work.
Yeah. Let me just say one thing. Someone else who holds very much the Equal America, and it has been represented in the energy at his rallies and in his campaigns, is Bernie Sanders. And in 2016, he came short to Smart America, and Hillary Clinton was the candidate, and then we had Trump. But very much, I think, in his passion and his appeal to young people is pretty much to the fifth narrative. When you list what you would do if you had the power to do it, it's very much what Bernie or Elizabeth Warren would attempt to do, and luckily what Biden seems to be trying to do.
Right. He's adopted a great deal of Warren's anti-monopoly agenda and of Sanders' pro-worker and rebuild the safety net and bring government back into people's lives as a force for good.
Yeah.
That is, to me, the best agenda. I don't think Bernie Sanders could ever have gotten it done as a politician. I don't think he had the ability. I think Biden, in his dotage and in his almost his being a throwback to something that precedes all four of these narratives, back to Roosevelt and Truman, somehow this least likely, most irrelevant politician turns out to be the one who might get it done.
The book is The Last Best Hope, America in Crisis and Renewal. You can learn more about the book at the publisher's website, macmillan.com. That's macmillan.com. And you can find all of George Packer's Atlantic articles at theatlanticoneword.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of guests and issues, plus 8 to 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You'll find years of podcasts at my site, terrencemcnally.net, or at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podomatic, or most podcast sites. Thank you to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, George Packer. Keep up the good work.
Thanks a lot, Terrence. See you next time.